All these things should make you realize like how much you don't know and how much uncertainty is really involved with this stuff. Yeah.
I think we've certainly accomplished that. Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, visit exomountaingear.com. Well, welcome to episode 159. The topic on today's episode is backcountry medicine and first aid, and how we as hunters can be prepared for the situations that we might encounter. Steve and I are both guilty of packing too light in the backcountry when it comes to first aid, both from a equipment and gear perspective as well as a knowledge perspective. And those two go hand in hand. I mean, it's pointless to have everything you need for a first aid emergency if you don't know how to use it. And so we talk about both of those topics tonight in this episode with a couple of guys from ARI Backcountry Medicine. So as you'll hear about, they both have different backgrounds, but they both specialize in backcountry medicine, first aid, outdoors, trauma, and more. And we really dive deep into topics. We get beyond the basic first aid kit and talk about things like tourniquets and quick clot and combat gauze, other emergency dressings. We also get into other items as well as that knowledge piece. So we talk about some techniques, we talk about some things that we all should know. And as you hear though, there's not one answer for every situation. There's a lot of gray area. There's a lot of what if. There's a lot we need to think through maybe in advance, as well as keep a clear head in a first aid situation and think through what we're doing, how we're doing it, and what are the ramifications. So it's an interesting topic, something that I feel we need to do more of. So if you guys have questions, we'd love to do more follow-up podcasts on this topic, maybe answer some of your questions specifically. You can send those questions to podcast@exomountaingear.com. As always, guys, thank you so much for tuning in. I hope that you take away something from this episode that you can use in the field, but I hope you never have to. All right, let's get into this discussion on first aid in the backcountry. All right, well, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. Excited to have you guys join us today as we talk about first aid, wilderness medical issues, and other items related. To begin with, Michael, you're on the line. You have some coworkers with you as well. If you could just go ahead and get a quick introduction of who all's there from your end, and then tell us a little bit about what you guys do with ARI's Medical, and kind of just give us context for you guys speaking to this these topics for this show.
I'm Mike Kremka. I'm an emergency physician in Missoula, Montana, and I do a lot of pre-hospital care as well as search and rescue and some tactical medicine. I'm a backcountry hunter, and I'm here with Trenton Harper. I'll let Trenton introduce himself.
Hi, I'm Trenton. I'm originally from West Virginia and came out to Montana over 15 years ago. I'm a critical care paramedic here in Missoula. I've worked as a paramedic ranger for the Park Service. Background in search and rescue here as well. And then I've been teaching for about 14 years for ARI Backcountry Medicine, which is based out of Missoula, Montana, but we teach all over the country to different organizations and then do a host of international stuff as well.
So ARI does a lot of wilderness medicine training as well as standard civilian EMS training. And we focus on kind of an experiential component. We offer a semester-long course through the university here that does everything from avalanche rescue, swift water rescue, technical rope rescue, in addition to the wilderness medicine training. We do more and more with the Forest Service for fire standby for large fires in the area. So a really good program here. It's having gone through EMT training before I became an emergency doctor, it's definitely some of the best EMT training I've had the privilege of being involved in. So
that'd be one hell of a fun college class.
Yeah, I think I went to the wrong school because I don't know, like things like calculus and organic chemistry. So,
So you guys is not only have like medical experience in more of a clinical type setting, you have this wilderness experience, first responder experience, and then as hunters yourselves, outdoorsmen yourselves, you kind of know what is possible, like the bad situations that we can get into. And we'll talk a bit more about situations later, but just to begin with, you know, it's pretty pathetic, what I carry in terms of a first aid kit. And Steve, I know it's the same way for you in terms of what we pack for the type of trips that we take. And that's not to say that the trips, you know, that we're risking our lives inherently, but it is to say that we overlook a lot of the things that could go bad, on even relatively short, trips. And we're just, honestly, we're not prepared. Not only do we not have what we need, we don't have the knowledge to use, some of the things that we should have. And so just to begin with, you know, there's those two components. There is the what, and then there is the when, and then the how in terms of putting those items to use. Well, let's talk a bit about the what first. In terms of what a backcountry hunter should have in their first aid kit, if you will. And again, for me, it's pathetic. It's like a bandage and some tape and some ibuprofen and tweezers. And that's honestly, that's about it. It's bad. Steve, is there anything on top of those basics that you carry regularly?
You know, the one thing I threw in there this year, and you guys could tell me if I'm crazy or not, was super glue. Just if you had someone told me you could use that to put together a pretty good cut. So that's it. Pretty much super glue, lots of duct tape, and a couple Band-Aids.
Yeah. So clearly you guys can see that we're professionals. Yeah. It's funny. I've researched previously, both for hunting trips as well as just some other things, some of the things I think I know I should have. And so I'm just going to mention some bigger categories, some other items, and then I'd love to kind of circle back to these and talk about if we should have them, and then also get your recommendations on other items we should have. So things like a tourniquet, things like quick clot or something related, you know, a better solution than just super glue, like should we be carrying an actual stitch kit or something like a zip stitch? Should we be carrying other medications? So yeah, those are some of the big categories. So let's just start with something like a tourniquet. It sounds so serious. In your guys' opinion, should a backcountry hunter be carrying something like a tourniquet?
Well, we actually have different opinions on this, I believe. So I think at this point in the past, what I would say is I would only consider carrying a tourniquet if I'm carrying a gun or someone around me is carrying a gun. And so that's for law enforcement and then rifle season, depending on where you're hunting. Hunting in Montana, I feel a lot safer than some of the places with more condensed population of folks hunting in smaller areas. That said, my father was shot hunting in Georgia in 1990 and through his thigh, had a life-threatening hemorrhage from that, and definitely saved his own life with an improvised tourniquet, which I think would have made his life a lot easier if he had had a pre-manufactured tourniquet. So at this point, because they are pretty lightweight, I carry one and I advocate for it. That said,
yeah, I think tourniquets are great. And there's, you know, overwhelming data now from the military that they save lives. And there's pretty good data from civilian pre-hospital care too, that they're a benefit. The pre-made tourniquets are great. It's a single use device, however. So I think that in certain situations where your risk is higher, especially like law enforcement, then carrying a tourniquet is a great idea. Carrying them on ambulances and fire engines, excellent idea. If I'm really trying to save weight in the backcountry, I might not carry it, but I would carry something that I know is as effective. And the only thing that I think is as effective is using military cravats, which are really, you know, high thread count cloth. It's like a triangular bandage you get in a cheap first aid kit, but made much better. And there's a specific technique for using those cravats as a tourniquet, using a dowel or some other item as a windlass, and how you tie that. And we actually made a little video for you guys and sent that to you. I don't know how the quality with that turned out, but that's what I carry for real wilderness stuff, because I can use it to make a sling, a swath, for splinting, for all sorts of other, for dressings, all sorts of other uses. I think tourniquets are great, though, and I would never say don't carry one of the two currently approved tourniquets out there if you're concerned about that. They are very light. They're relatively inexpensive. The only two that I would recommend currently are the Combat Applications Tourniquet and the Softy from Tactical Medical Solutions. It's like the Special Operations Forces Tactical Tourniquet. Both of those tourniquets have been proven to be good. They're durable. They're made of quality material. We carry one over the other in this system, but I think they're both good devices. So
I think the take home with tourniquets and massive hemorrhage control is don't expect to come up with the idea after the event occurs. So if you're every hunter, bow, archery, you know, or rifle should go out knowing how they're going to control massive hemorrhage in an extremity. And I'll just put another thing there is, like, you should also think about that when you go to the range, because there's a lot of incidents that happen at the range, and there's been some case studies of tourniquet applications there as well.
In our system here, we've had two successful tourniquet applications by law enforcement for people who've had life-threatening bleeding from car accidents or motorcycle accidents with near amputation of the extremity. So maybe even just driving to your, you know, where you're going to hunting is where you're going to incur the highest risk. I think they're great devices. I would always recommend having a good way that you have practiced that is approved to do a tourniquet, or one of the two commercially available devices.
Okay. Well, you guys have mentioned massive hemorrhage, so go ahead and lay out just some, I don't want to say guidelines, but give us an idea of when and when not to use a tourniquet. If we so have one.
There's a downside, right, of if you do a tourniquet, maybe do it too wrong, too tight, you could lose, you know, the limb beyond the tourniquet.
Massive hemorrhage is where you're going to bleed to death. It's not like it's oozing blood continuously and you hold pressure on it, it doesn't stop. It's like where blood is spraying out. And that is where you have an injury to the large arteries, usually in the, you know, upper arm or upper thigh, or maybe an amputation type injury. But it's massive blood loss that if you don't stop soon, you could bleed to the point where you're unconscious and then unable to provide any care for yourself. So, you know, it may take several minutes to bleed to the point of unconsciousness with a minor injury, but a severe complete injury that could happen potentially as quickly as, like, 30, 40 seconds. So this is like truly life-threatening bleeding. It's not the kind of bleeding that most people see outside of the military situation, even in civilian EMS, because response times are such that this kind of bleeding has already led to someone dying before an ambulance can get there. Tourniquet is too tight. So a properly made tourniquet is designed to disperse the compression over a wider area to prevent crush injury. So some older tourniquets from World War II were a dowel and a piece of rope, and that caused terrible crush injury that basically, once you put it on tight enough to stop bleeding, it resulted in damage to the nerves and limb vessels and blood vessels to the point that the limb was not salvageable. Modern tourniquets have been left on for 4 hours on an upper extremity and 6 hours on a lower extremity with minimal risk of, you know, damage to that limb. And some have been even left on longer with the preservation of the limb as well. The tourniquet has to be tight enough to stop the bleeding. So it has to be really, it's going to be terrible uncomfortable. So
yeah, the one guy I've applied one to had a gunshot to like his lower thigh area. Now, granted, there was some alcohol involved in this situation, but once I put the tourniquet on him, he complained of more pain from the tourniquet than the hole in his leg. So that is something that people can then, if they're untrained or uneducated on it, think that they're doing it wrong, and that actually means you're probably doing it correctly. And so the concept, though, that you're doing it too tight, you should let go of that, because that's at this point not really accurate to you. Okay. You want it to completely stop all blood flow into that extremity. And if you don't do that, you actually may have other complications from the tourniquet application.
So another item related to stopping blood loss that you see pop up if you get into, I would say, like more advanced first aid is something like quick clot, combat gauze, et cetera. Can you guys explain what that is? Talk about the use of it, if we should be carrying it.
So quick clot is an evolution of a product that was originally like a lava rock that caused like cautery, basically through a chemical reaction that generated heat. The newer quick clot is it's a different mineral called kaolin, and it's impregnated into a gauze that can be packed into a wound that you can't tourniquet. So the typical locations for this would be kind of at what they call junctional sites between the torso and the extremities, like the neck, the armpits, the groin. Everyone's probably seen Black Hawk Down. That's really life-threatening bleeding, and that is the type of wound where you can't tourniquet and you need to be able to pack stuff deep into the wound. Now, that's not a skill that most people in any type of first aid course are going to get outside of, you know, military and now more modern courses that are out there, like the Stop the Bleed course. These products are good. There's another one out there, Kytagauze, which is a shrimp shell protein that generates blood clot as well. And both of those products are marginally better than regular gauze. Maybe, I think that they said something like, 3 to 5% better? I'm not sure of the exact numbers. Now, I carry it, again, for high-risk situations where I or people around me might get shot. But if in the backcountry, again, it's like a pretty specific product. It has a shelf life that expires, and it's only marginally better than like Curlix gauze, the big rolls of bulky gauze. The more important than carrying it, though, again, with any of this stuff, and I guess we'll talk about it later probably, is like the training to be able to use it, because that, again, that is not a skill that if you don't know how, if you've never tried to do that skill or been trained to do it, the likelihood of you successfully being able to do it on the spot, again, is going to be pretty low. So I don't know if that answers the question of whether you should carry it or not. It depends on your training and, you know, all that kind of risk assessment and weight considerations. Like, are you going to carry another product that is only for one specific thing that's really expensive, or are you going to carry something more general?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the more general product that we both would agree on that you should carry is, it's a name brand, but everyone just refers to it as Curlex gauze. So, you know, most first aid kits you buy pre-made will have what are really just little roll gauze. And those are fine and multi-use, but they're not ideal. And Curlex is this big, bulky, 4-inch dressing that's usually, if you get it in just the traditional fashion, is about 16 feet, I think. And you can vacuum seal that yourself down to where it's a couple ounces, and it is absolutely multiple use, because you could use it for hemorrhage control, but you could use it for all your splinting needs. You could cut it down just for small wound care, and it also functions well as toilet paper if you get desperate.
In a true emergency situation.
Yeah.
I've not thought of that before.
So. Yeah.
But.
And then with that, if you're going to, I mean, this is something any, you know, folks, if they have at least basic first aid supplies around their house, they could throw in without having to purchase special products, is some kind of Curlex or roll gauze. And then in addition to that is a decent, you know, ace bandage, stretchy wrap of whatever sort. And so often if you get like a ultra light first aid kit from, you know, REI or wherever, it'll be a 3-inch or even smaller ace that's in there. I would not recommend carrying those. I'd at least carry a 3-inch to even a 4-inch ace wrap. And then you could do what's called a pressure dressing with that. This would be the more simple or improvised version of what's generally called like a combat dressing or a trauma dressing, the Israeli dressing being the classic one, but there's a lot of other ones out there. But really those are just kind of bulked up ace bandages with some extra gauze. And for a lot of bleeds, maybe not a thigh, depending on how big your thigh is, but other extremity bleeds, that's what I used for years before tourniquets came back around for all the bleeds I ever encountered.
So gauze, I guess I was under the impression gauze just kind of absorbed a little bit of blood, but it actually helps clot up the wound.
So the Curlex is the best thing here, is where we're actually not just laying it over the wound, which is like the classic, you know, American Red Cross 1982 version. But what we're really doing now is what's called wound packing. So if you actually have a hole, you're trying to identify where the bleeding's occurring in that hole, especially if there's arterial bleeding. So you'll actually potentially see spurting within that. And you're going to take the initial little kind of wad of gauze from the end of the roll gauze and pack, you know, you're putting your fingers into the wound and pack on top of that artery. And then you're taking the rest of this 16 feet or so of roll gauze and pretty like very systematically packing that into the hole so that you're actually filling the hole and adding pressure against the artery. When I first learned it, the guy that taught it said to the bone, you're packing to the bone. And so you're getting it so that you're actually pressing into the wound, and then you're wrapping the ace bandage around it to actually further compress it against the bone underneath. And that's what's actually helping the body form its own clot.
It does create kind of a matrix for a clot to form around. So if you have a wound cavity and it's filled up with blood, clot will develop in there, but it's getting pushed out by the pressure of our arterial bleeding. And even if it stops shortly, that clot kind of liquefies a little bit and then it kind of starts bleeding again. So you can, it just, until you like fill that cavity up and distend it with this gauze, whichever, whether you use a hemostatic gauze or, you know, just standard Curlex type gauze, that is going to kind of keep bleeding there. So especially with arterial bleeding, I see a lot of wounds that are like pretty minor and people want to use tourniquets or these types of devices, and then there's not really significant bleeding. You know, we'd probably be better off like going to the sink and washing it out and then putting, and then just holding pressure on it, you know, when with non-life threatening bleeding. But we're talking about like the truly life threatening.
Truly life threatening. Yeah. I'm thinking like you jammed a broadhead into your thigh and it went 2 inches in there, and, you know, obviously it's going to bleed like crazy, but that's not necessarily a wound that's so big you're sticking your fingers down in there to pack that in.
Yeah. Now you do that, you jam that broad, you follow your tree stand and jam that in your leg, and it's in your femoral artery. That's a different situation.
Right.
You know, don't pull that thing out too. But
yeah.
That's a good point though. I mean, you want to talk about why we wouldn't do that in a puncture situation?
Pulling the arrow out?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the risk there is that you have injured, minorly injured a structure that's kind of like clotted off in there. But you pull it out, and then you pull it out in a different orientation, and you create additional wound, or you know, you pull that broadhead back through the artery, and then now you've created a worse wound, and now you have deep bleeding from a site you can't control easily. And you know, a broadhead wound is going to be much smaller than, you know, a rifle type wound where you might be able to pack stuff in there. It might be much harder to pack into that type of wound. Any impaled object in general, you should leave in place. And we've had a number of wilderness situations where we had a guy fall on a stick and it went in behind his knee and, you know, came out through the front of just below the knee. And we had to kind of figure out how we're going to splint that in place. You know, there's an artery right near there. We don't want to pull that out. He wasn't bleeding at that time. We didn't want to make things worse than it already was. So.
And then as far as broadheads go, I mean, I think there were two incidents in Montana this season, early season of, and I think they were both thigh injuries. I heard of at least one flown out of Montana, one flown out of Idaho, and then an incident in Alaska as well. And I believe it was the Alaska incident that there was then a, I'm not sure what law enforcement it was that actually applied a tourniquet to it. I believe the other two didn't get tourniquets. And it is worth noting, like, yeah, most of the injuries that you're going to encounter probably aren't the massive hemorrhage that we're talking about. And the idea of, I was thinking about this yesterday, walking in the woods, is, yeah, a lot of people, including people in the military and law enforcement, carry tourniquets their entire careers and never use them. And, you know, if you start carrying a tourniquet or planning for this stuff and you go however many years with no incidents, it's easy to start thinking, well, maybe I don't need to be carrying this gear or recerting on the training. But that's the point is, yeah, you may never use it, but you don't want to be the idiot that doesn't know how to take care of it the one time it happens.
Yeah, that's always the balance, right? I mean, in all this, we're essentially talking about what could happen, and it's easy to convince ourselves that we either don't need it, or it's easy to convince ourselves that, you know, we have to be prepared for everything and now pack everything. And that's the balance and personal decision that goes into all this, I think.
I mean, hopefully most backcountry skiers, you know, never use their beacons, but they're still, or, you know, whether they're on sleds or whatever, but, you know, winter users in avalanche terrain, universally, everybody knows you wear a beacon every time. And I don't think most people are planning on using their beacon the day they go out, you know, any day that they go out, hopefully. So, but you should still have it.
So with tourniquets, with QuikClot, with essentially building this emergency trauma dressing with the gauze and the bandage, we've covered, I would say, more severe blood loss. What about, and this gets into, I think, you know, certain types of bandages, like in terms of butterflies or Steve's question about glue or even stitching, things like zip stitch. What about cuts? Maybe this is a broadhead wound. Maybe this is a knife wound, but clearly cuts are something that's probably more likely than anything, I would think, as backcountry hunters using knives, using broadheads and that type of thing. So help us assess cuts and then the best treatment option for cuts based on maybe depth, based on the blood, and then talk us through some of the things that we maybe should have in our pack to address those types of wounds.
Yeah, so I guess I'd kind of put it into a couple different categories is, first of all, there's like cuts on your, you know, fingers from you tighten your broadhead without a wrench or something and you get like a razor blade cut on your finger. It's not grossly contaminated. That's when the super glue that you're talking about can be super helpful. Those kind of wounds, maybe small wounds on the face. Those wounds you have to get those wounds to stop bleeding before you can glue them because the blood creates like a ball of dried blood and glue that prevents the wound from closing. So you really have to close the wound and put the glue across the closed wound for using that kind of material. I use super glue on my hands all the time if I cut a finger doing stuff. I think the face is another good location. Anywhere that doesn't have a lot of tension across it, because if there's a lot of tension across it or a gaping wound, a big irregular wound, that stuff's just not going to work for you. You can't put it directly in the wound. So then the kind of second thing I'm going to think about is, you know, big wilderness contaminated wound. That's a much different situation. If you close a wound like that, your chances of getting an infection are super high, no matter how well you clean it out in the backcountry, because there's probably, you know, foreign body in there, like organic material like dirt or wood, you know, rivers, stuff like that. Big wounds like where there's exposed fat tissue, you know, just not just the skin, but subcutaneous tissue, the fatty tissue that insulates us underneath. Big wounds, anything that involves the muscle or tendon or a joint, those wounds probably going to have to leave open. And that's another concept that I think most people aren't really familiar with is like, what do you do with that? Well, you have this Curlex gauze again. You might have to kind of pack that wound with some moistened gauze with water you purified as much as possible. Probably boiling would be ideal. And then you have like a gauze pack in the large wound. You've removed as much of the material out of it as you can, and then kind of a dressing over the top. And even in healthcare settings, we may leave those wounds open for a couple days before they get closed. Wounds that affect your ability to get yourself out of the wilderness or another situation, you might not be able to do some of that stuff. There's a lot of considerations that are going to go into that. But in general, large, deep wounds that are contaminated, especially in the wilderness, you're going to want to probably leave open. Mm-hmm. So staplers, stuff like that, unless you have someone who has a lot of specialty training, that kind of stuff is probably not worth your buck carrying. So,
yeah, I think, there's really good case studies on this for even experienced providers suturing wounds in a backcountry setting, and the person's still getting an infection. And one thing we've seen over the years with teaching, and I'm completely guilty of this as a paramedic, is we just talk about anytime you give someone the ability to do something, they're more likely to implement a skill they've learned than to actually implement the thought process that's necessary to make that a good idea. And so if someone, practices suturing on a pig's foot and starts carrying sutures or a stapler, they're more likely to just staple a wound shut than to actually go through the thought process of, hey, this is a high-risk wound. I actually need to do the less sexy intervention of just keeping it clean and monitoring it over the next several days as it heals on its own. And instead of wanting to just, staple it. And I don't carry any specific wound closure stuff for the most part, other than maybe some super glue. I've had to open people's wounds back up that I had closed with glue. Steri-strips. But again, that's an intervention. Wound closure is an intervention that I would just say, you have to do some reading, if not some training, to know what you're getting into.
So I had a pretty bad cut on a hunt. It wasn't a backcountry hunt, but I essentially sliced open my finger pretty good. It laid flat open. There was the fat tissue I could see. I was in town, so I went and got care right away. It ended up being, I think, 10 or 11 stitches. Is that the type of wound where, say, I am in a backcountry multi-day hunt, even if I could get the blood to stop with whatever means, which would probably be crude if it were me doing it, is that something where I should cut the trip short and then go get proper care, even if the pain was under control, even if the blood loss was under control, simply for the fact of I need to get that thing cleaned and irrigated? And then either, as you mentioned, remain open for a bit or properly closed once it has been cleaned and I know there's no risk of infection. So, just help us understand with a cut specifically, if the pain's tolerable, if the blood loss is, under control, is the big danger staying out there and then getting an infection?
Yeah, I think there's a bunch of things to think about. I mean, first of all, if you cut your finger pretty bad, you're probably not going to bleed to death, first of all, unless you're on some blood thinning medication. And even then, it's going to take a lot of time, the small blood vessels down there. If you injure something that's functional in your hand, like tendons, or even the sheath that's over the tendon, you get a tendon infection. That even if that is treated with antibiotics and surgery rapidly, you can have long-term problems with that hand. Your hands are pretty important to what we do day to day, most of us, I would guess. And so, a deep hand wound that involves the deeper structures of your hand, joints, tendons, the sheath, muscle, that stuff you should, unless there's some reason you can't evacuate, I would get out for that kind of stuff. Your hands are super important for you.
And what we'd think about is, how are you going to evacuate? Are you going to use your in-reach device and, hope a helicopter shows up? No, that's not necessary. And are you going to run yourself to the trailhead? Probably not. But maybe you are going to consider hiking yourself out and going in on your own. As you were asking, I was thinking, well, it's kind of gray because I'm looking at scars on my fingers as we talk, that I, didn't evacuate or didn't get any kind of definitive care for. But I will say, you know, I've cut probably less than what you're describing, you know, while processing an animal and, you know, with the dirty knife, and it, you know, I did irrigate it out with a syringe, you know, with some high pressure irrigation. It still got minorly infected multiple times. And so then I was also having to like, do hot soaks a couple times a day over about a week, really, to keep it from like spreading as infection. And so I think the other aspect of that is having a knowledge base to actually evaluate, okay, well, do we really know what tendons look like? Or, you know what fat tissue looks like. Do you think there's other structures? And then being able to also evaluate like early signs of infection. If you're going to stay, you got to be paranoid enough to diligently keep an eye on that, not just the wound, but the person as a whole. Because some of these infections, yeah, like people can get systemic infections that come up quicker than you think. And that can happen. I mean, we know of wildland firefighters that have ended up, you know, septic, which is absolutely life-threatening systemic infection from infected blisters that they didn't care for. And so, you know, I always feel like a parent talking to people, you know, because I know most folks are going to be like, if I cut my finger, I'm not doing an evac. And that's fine. I agree. I'm probably not going to either. But it needs to be informed and not just like, you know, I'll tough it out. Because we've just seen over and over with case studies of friends, if not some of our instructors, who have ended up really sick because they just blew simple things off. And so, you know, one of our tenets here is keep simple things simple. And so if you have a wound and it's simple, keep it that way. Don't let it progress to getting worse.
Yeah, I've just always wondered about that personally. Like if this was same wound 2 or 3 days into what was supposed to be a week-long hunt, like if I felt like I got under control, would it be smart to try and finish that out, or am I just setting myself up for failure? But sounds like there's no clear line necessarily.
I think the reality is you're probably going to try to stay.
Yeah.
Right. And most people are, I would. And so what you need to do is like fall back on actually doing a self-assessment and then trying to really look at it objectively and not just a subjective decision that, hey, I don't want to leave, you know, and have it be an informed decision.
A lot of what we've talked about, the items need knowledge to be used properly. Maybe we do or don't need them. Maybe we do or don't know how to use them. But covering the basics. So getting back to helping a backcountry hunter have a smart first aid kit. Let's just say on average, I know there's all kinds of scenarios with experience and knowledge and time of year and season and all that, but can we hit the basics? Like, let's go through and hit, and if we can say this, what everybody should have ideally in their first aid kit.
Yeah, so let's start specifically with medical. Obviously, bleeding control. And I would break that into massive hemorrhage and just simple bleeding control. So the stuff we talked about, ACE bandage, roll gauze or Curlex. And then for the more simple bleeds, yeah, some type of some 4x4 gauze, having then bridging into what we usually put in as a separate category of just wound care, having some little, you know, non-stick gauze to put on those cuts so that you're not having to use just regular old 4x4 gauze that kind of sticks into the wound. I think it's worth considering carrying like a small 10 milliliter syringe to irrigate out these wounds we're talking about that you might stay for, so that you can actually add some pressure. There are improvised ways to do that, but I just haven't had good success with those. So I usually carry a little syringe specifically to irrigate my wounds with.
Can you elaborate on that real quick? Just as far as like,
yeah. So like if you ever got a wisdom tooth removed, they'll give you the little syringe that has the little hook on the end that you can kind of irrigate out that cavity with.
Mm-hmm.
Those are ideal. It's really any kind of little syringe bigger than 10 milliliters or the same. And the idea would be, hey, you cut your finger open or whatever, you stop the bleeding, and then you're looking in the wound, knowing that even if you cut it with the cleanest knife or whatever, it's going to have bacteria and all in there besides just gross debris. And then you're just using really half to an entire Nalgene's worth of water to just sit there and irrigate. And the idea being that you're not just cleaning out the stuff you can see, you're cleaning out bacteria and you're reducing the bacteria count. And even if you don't get everything out, you're still reducing the chances of infection, reducing the numbers that your body has to fight against. And that's really the absolute foundation of wilderness wound care.
Yeah, the sooner you do that kind of irrigation of the wound and removing all the grossly contaminated stuff in there, the lower the risk of infection. So in minor wounds, like your finger you're talking about, you'd be better off like washing that out before you even try and control the bleeding in that setting. So, because the bleeding may look like a fair amount, but it's not life-threatening.
And you mentioned in terms of what to use for irrigating that out, boiled water would be your best choice in the backcountry?
Yeah, you just use potable water, really whatever it is you're using to treat your water that you're drinking should be fine. And yeah, if you've got fuel to do so and time, and you want to make it even cleaner, then bringing water to a rolling boil is just the easy fallback method. But if you're filtering your water, if you're using UV or you're using halogens, either a chlorine base or iodine tabs or whatever, any of those are fine. And there's multiple studies in hospitals that show that tap water actually had better healing than actual sterile water. So we're not really worried about creating it sterile. We're actually just needing the mechanical aspect of using, you're not using out of the beaver pond, but you're using clean water and then mechanically flushing out the wound.
So initially you could use like your Camelback until you can do more dedicated, but you're like washing that wound out right away is the key. So,
yeah. Okay.
So don't go down to the stream and wash it in that. I'm pretty sure I've done that before.
No, it would be better not to. And okay. if you end up doing that for whatever reason, then follow it up with, clean water.
Yeah. Okay. So. And you said like literally half of an Nalgene full. So, I mean, you're going to fill that syringe up 20, 30 times and just keep cleaning.
Yeah. It's the solution to pollution is dilution. I think that's the saying, right? But it's just a lot of water and a lot of time.
Okay.
And so then continuing along that with other wound care, blister, either we'd want to say blister prevention, but then also just blister care, and just thinking about your feet, your hands for wound care. Prevention's always better than actually having to treat any of these things. And then really more common, I would say, is orthopedic injuries, sprains and strains and possibly fractures. And whether or not you specifically carry a splint, like a SAM splint, which I think most people are familiar with, those do have multiple uses. I would say most people, especially if you're going ultralight, cannot justify carrying that. So then what I would say is look at your gear. And this is what we do with a lot of, especially our wilderness first responder courses, is just have people bring their own gear in and say, okay, well, how are you going to use that to do an ankle splint, a full leg splint, an arm splint?
Can you give us some examples? Like, are we talking tent pole? Like, what are common items that we might carry that we could use as a splint?
Yeah, well, traditionally, like the closed cell phone ground pads were the easiest multi-use item. And I think those are less popular now, but they're a lot easier to do all kinds of splinting options with than the more like, and kind of 3 to 4 inch thick inflatable ground pads that most of us are using now.
You can use the ground pads to create a splint though. And that is something I've actually done in the wilderness for someone who broke both their heel bones. And it worked really well. So, you can, you know, wrap that around, and then secure it and then inflate it. And it becomes relatively stiff just by itself, or you can add things like, you know, poles and stuff like that for stiffeners. So,
yeah. And poles are an option, trekking poles or, shooting sticks or whatever you might have, you know, depending on your pack style, you know, some packs still have removable stays. And obviously you can just use sticks. But what I always recommend is that if you're splinting an actual fracture, suspected fracture with any kind of natural materials, and really even a tent pole, is don't ever have that directly in contact with the skin. You always want something for padding. And so then just think about those kind of options within your general gear, you know, like extra pairs of socks, as long as they're clean, are great padding and splint options for all kinds of things. Another, like if you really want to improvise a perfect SAM splint, is if you have a windscreen, depending on your stove type, if you have a stove, but you know, the classic MSR, windscreen, with the whisper lights, if you fold that over and stretch a sock over it, it's a great SAM splint. And so there's just like tons of MacGyver tricks that you can come up with, but it really just takes looking at your personal gear, thinking about the different things you might need to improvise, and then playing around with it. And with that, then obviously tape, both for wound care, but also for splinting. I tend to carry just a little kind of Ace Hardware miniature roll of duct tape. Mike probably has a better option than that, but
no, that's what I carry. I don't carry a lot of specific stuff like that, cause then I can only use it for one thing. So,
yeah, I mean, I duct tape for all kinds of medical options, is besides just fixing things, is good and definitely worth its weight. As long as you're, you know, carrying it smartly and not just carrying a full roll. So, we talked earlier about a cravat, which it, most folks would know is like a triangular bandage. I think if you are going to carry something like that, I would recommend paying the $2 or $3, to get one of the heavier military style ones. And then I try to just carry stuff that, you know, have, I can justify multiple uses for, and something like that, I'm going to carry it and actually use it for just day-to-day stuff. So that's going to be my handkerchief. And then if I need to use it, yeah, I've got it. So we got bleeding control, we've got wound care, we've got splinting and orthopedic. And then you could think about just medications. So you mentioned, you know, pretty much carrying ibuprofen. I think if that's what works for you, that's, you know, some kind of a pain anti-inflammatory is good. I have moved to care. I used to always religiously be ibuprofen as well. And now for small reasons that Mike can talk about more, I've moved to using Tylenol. But I will say in my little vacuum sealed take it everywhere first aid kit, I have my own little pill pack that is, hey, I fall and break my leg or something, I've got a max dose of ibuprofen, a max dose of Tylenol in there. And my intent is that I'm going to take them both at the same time for severe pain. And that way, yeah, I also, you know, it's worth considering carrying something with a prescription narcotic option. But I know that I can do that without, if I'm even by myself and I'm not going to kind of zonk myself out. You want to talk to pain meds?
Yeah. I mean, pain medications, there's plus and minuses too. It's a controlled substance. So, you know, that's a drawback for, you know, it has to be prescribed to you. If you're going to give it to other people, there's legalities with that. I mean, and this, I think unless it was really like a gross violation of something, you're not going to get prosecuted for that. But there are issues with carrying narcotics. Potentially too, you know, you've given someone something and now they're not able to care for themselves as well because they're, you know, sedated. So, but you know, the kind of other things thinking about carrying would be, you know, something for allergic reactions like, you know, Benadryl or a non-sedating antihistamine like Zyrtec. stuff for, you know, simple stuff for like heartburn or diarrhea. An epinephrine auto injector would be something, especially if you're with a group of people and you're responsible for them and knowing how to use it for a severe allergic reaction. Because, you know, if you really have severe allergic reaction, Benadryl alone is not going to fix that problem. And, you know, that'd be something that's life-saving. That's the really the only injectable I routinely carry in the backcountry in the absence of some other specific situations. So, dental stuff, maybe for prolonged things, like something to take care of like dental pain, like the topical stuff you can get at the store, temporary filling type stuff. We talked about splinting stuff. I think really long trips, you might consider antibiotics based on what stuff is likely in the area. Again, that's going to be more advanced stuff that you'd have to look into. And then people who are on prescription medicines, they need to make sure that they have an adequate supply of whatever their regular medications are so that they're able to deal with that. And you would probably want to give yourself a buffer of extra in case you had to spend longer than you anticipated. So a bunch of other like general stuff would be like a light source. Everyone has a headlamp, you know, something to record some notes on, especially for a prolonged care thing. Gloves, I think, are a good idea. Some, you know, you may decide not to use gloves based on, you know, how well you know people, but there are other risks with that, you know, so that's something you have to decide on your own. Scissors, the tweezers you carry, I think are important. You know, if you get a splinter in there that develops into an infection that you could have removed if you had a good quality pair of tweezers, that's actually a big deal in the wilderness. So, you know, again, organic foreign body in the finger is going to, or your foot, may be a big deal for you.
And so, we don't have, our only ticks here are luckily still the larger ticks. But if you're especially, I mean, if you're in any tick area, you need to have some type of reliable, like good tweezers that actually line up. But especially if you're in areas with the deer ticks, the smaller ones, some means of removing those. And I would add in with that, whether you want to put it in your first aid kit category, but is especially if you're by yourself or not really close friends with your hunting partner, is some type of mirror to do tick checks on yourself in those hard to reach places that ticks always seem to like to get and embed into.
Good. There are other things you can carry in a first aid kit, but a lot of that stuff is not stuff that you necessarily need. A lot of the pre-bought first aid kits have a lot of stuff in it that you're probably are like the boo-boo kit. And that's not the kind of stuff that most of us are going to use in a real medical scenario. That's the kind of stuff we'd use to take care of ourselves kind of day to day. Fingertip band-aids, some regular band-aids. Foot care stuff is super important because that really may impact your ability to get out of the situation comfortably. Or, you know, so if there's altitude issues, you have to deal with those kind of medications. Let's see, trying to think of other specific things.
Yeah. Do you guys have any prompts or questions so far?
Just taking notes. That's all good stuff. Yeah. I'm curious, I guess, on, you know, it got my curiosity piqued when you mentioned the blisters before and that leading to infection, and whether we're talking about like that extent of a medical issue or just like in general foot care. Cause I think there's different schools of thought or different experiences. What has been your experience in terms of just blister control, blister management, blister treatment?
So for prevention, I think if you know where you get like if you have a pair of boots and you know that you have trouble, like for me, I have trouble with my heels in almost every boot I have. So if I'm really going to do something where I'm going to be putting a lot of miles in, I'm going to, you know, try and prevent that. So I really like the physical therapy KT tape. It's really slick on the outside. It's really thin compared to moleskin. And I, you know, glue that down with something like Mastisol, you know, like your athletic trainer sprays on your foot before they wrap you up or something like that. So I'll put that adhesive down. I'll let that get tacky, kind of dry. And then I'll cut a piece of the material with kind of rounded edges. That KT tape is the physical therapy tape you see athletes putting over their, you know, shoulders or calves or whatever. And then I'll put that over my heels. And I've had super good luck I did a 16-hour endurance event, and that stuff stayed on the whole time. And that was like through water and everything. If you actually get a blister, there's lots of different ideas. Now you can pad around it, but I found a lot of times that, you know, there's moisture in your foot, in your sock or your boot, and you get that stuff balls up and then creates another hot spot right next to your blister. And you try and, you know, cut the donut out is what they always tell you. So there, you know, there are some other techniques you can use for that. The one that I've had the best luck with is if it's like a big tense blister and I really need to cover ground, is I'll drain it. And then I've actually put a little bit of zinc oxide stuff inside of it. I've actually injected it with a syringe, a tiny bit, and then put a dressing over the top with this same KT tape stuff. And I've had good luck with that. There's a lot of blister control stuff you can look at on like the ultra marathon sites, like where they talk about, because those guys get ridiculous blisters and they have like some pretty good wound care stuff for blisters on those websites.
I'll back up a little bit to some other prevention stuff. Is just keep your feet dry, you know, and have options for keeping them dry. And just thinking about, well, what forms a hot spot becoming a blister is, you know, combination of heat, moisture, and friction. And so anything you can do to address those three things, you know, have your boots that fit, obviously, I hope. But then, you know, having some folks really like, you know, multiple layers of socks. I've never had good success with anything more than a single good sock myself. But kind of figuring those things out and experimenting with your own feet to figure out what works best there. But having, I mean, that's one of my universal, like in the pack, is an extra pair of socks. And it's also just good for positive mental attitude to be able to like change your socks when things are cold and wet. And then especially on long trips, you know, is if you're covering a lot of ground, especially if it's hot out, is having some discipline of letting your feet air out, letting your boots and socks air out when you can. So if you're stopping for lunch and you know you're going to be sitting there for even 15 or 20 minutes, then actually just pull your feet out and let them air out would be really helpful. And then either foot powders to reduce moisture, or a lot of folks and a lot of athletes use some type of lubricant on their feet as well. And so just realizing like these are options if you're not already doing these things for yourself. Tricks then for actual like sticking stuff to your feet. I am pretty religious about carrying alcohol swabs. So just the little pads, you know, that are impregnated with alcohol, because you can use them as fire starters. You can use them to clean your tweezers after you pull the bloody tick out or whatever. But then anytime I'm sticking anything to my feet, I first wipe my foot down with alcohol, and that just removes the skin oils and lets everything stick better. And then a thing that Mike mentioned that I think isn't intuitive, or, you know, if you haven't taken a class or thought about it, is having something that creates tackiness or sticky, you know, helps either duct tape or whatever you're using on your feet. It helps it stick. You know, or if you're using the pre-made like Blista Band type blister care, I forget what those are called. I think they're called Blista Band, but they pretty much look like a little blister. Even those, I'll still use something underneath to help it stick to my foot. And then some type of tape option. And duct tape works really well for your feet as well. And just anytime you're sticking something to your feet, wipe it with alcohol, put some kind of stickiness underneath, and then trim the edges of anything so that you're not putting tape or bandages on your feet that have corners, because they just always end up peeling. And so having some type of little scissors or something, even the scissors on your multi-tool or whatever, and just trimming it so it has rounded edges so it stays on your foot longer.
We've used Leuco tape in the past, and it seems to stick really well without some sort of adhesive. Is there any downsides or considerations with Leuco tape that you guys are aware of?
I'm not familiar with that product as much. Okay. I think the one thing with duct tape is it doesn't breathe well.
Yeah.
So that is one, and it can cause skin breakdown underneath if you leave it on for too long. So, yeah. And I think that's probably true of most adhesive tapes. The KT tape does breathe some, which is nice. Yeah. I think that's great stuff. That's one.
If you've got something that sticks, awesome. Go with that. And then just consider, I mean, again, it's kind of sounds parental or something, but you know, the first rule of medicine, this is always covered in a class. First rule of medicine is do no harm. And then the more experience I've gained over the years, I've realized how easy it is to do harm and even just small things. And so sticking tape on your foot, not letting it breathe, and then getting actual like a wound under the tape, because you didn't like peel it off at night and change it the next day. And those are more the things that you gain from like additional training and experience.
Good. Well, fellas, we've covered some good ground. Definitely. I've taken some notes, learned some things, found some things to go learn more about and investigate. So this has been awesome. You know, we might have to do it again in the future, maybe with some listener questions, things like that, getting us more specific scenarios, but we really appreciate the time that you guys have already given us. And, thanks so much for sharing your knowledge with us.
Yeah. Can't emphasize enough how much the training component is important. And then, you know, just the preparation in advance, your physical fitness, you know, the pre-planning the area you're going to be in, letting people know where you're going to be, how are you going to make contact? Do you set up, you know, times that you're going to make contact at in advance so that people aren't worried about you and know when, how many missed calls before they send search and rescue after you, you know, all those kind of things to think about. All that pre-planning is, you know, so important. So,
yeah. So where can listeners go to learn more about the training that you guys offer? And then are there any other resources for training that you would recommend for folks who are, you know, different part of the country, overseas? We have listeners all over. So if you could provide some information on both those, that'd be great.
I'll just say, you know, we teach for Aerie Backcountry Medicine, and, you know, we're based in Montana. We'd love to have you come take a trip to Montana and take a class with us. You can find us at AerieMedicine.com. So Aerie spelled AERIE medicine.com. That said, all of our competitors that we know of are great educators. And the wilderness medicine industry as a whole is just full of really creative, really knowledgeable, experienced folks that are teaching really good courses all over the world. And so if you just, especially international listeners, if you're looking for a class, just, you know, Google search wilderness medicine classes in your area. You're welcome to, you know, run it by us. If we know of them, I'm happy to, you know, like recommend worthy competitors to our company. We're not just out for profit here. So there's great folks all over. And yeah, I'd say that's the best way. My email's Trenton@AerieMed.com. And do you have a AerieMed one? Or
I do not. Okay. You can get a hold of me through Trenton.
Yeah. So if folks have questions, we do a lot more in-depth stuff with medicine. And then also I teach a lot of our adjunct, like survival skills components as well.
What's the typical medicine course like in 1 day, 2 day, week long?
So the kind of industry standards are a 16-hour, which is a 2-day course called a wilderness first aid. And that is a really good intro. Usually what we'd say with that class is that's someone that maybe is working, leading small groups, but is within a normal response distance to normal EMS, you know, emergency care, ambulance, being able to pretty much get to them easily. A wilderness first responder class is anywhere from kind of 8 to 10 day course. That's really an industry standard for folks who are actually guiding or doing more extended trips or international trips. That's a real certification. I am still continually impressed by just how useful that knowledge base is. So you go through all of these subjects in depth. But really the more valuable part of taking a class that long is that you just do a lot of scenarios. And you get to actually practice and learn how to do a patient assessment system, which is universally applicable to any kind of sick or injured person. And you just get a lot more in depth with the actual decision making, which I think we've covered is really the core of all this wilderness medicine stuff. Awesome. Beyond that, if you really want to do it or you're leading big trips, we do wilderness EMT courses. And then especially if you have listeners that are still in school and doing some type of outdoor related or medicine otherwise related focus, if you look at our semesters in wilderness medicine, these are our Uber courses that Mike mentioned at the beginning. And they're 15 credits through the University of Montana. They're upper division credits, which is impressive. They're 300 level credits. And folks really get like come out with like some real competency in these things. So.
All these things should make you realize like how much you don't know and how much uncertainty is really involved with this stuff.
I think we've certainly accomplished that.
There are not as many black and whites as some people would have you believe. And and good decision making is really important.
Well, that's a wrap on this one. As I mentioned in the introduction, we will do more on this. So I want to hear your questions, like what topics, what gear, what techniques, what knowledge piece do you want to know? Do you think you need to know about first aid? Send that over by email to podcast@exomountaingear.com. As always, guys, truly do mean it. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to leave a review or something like that, it would help us tremendously. And we will catch you next week.